Chapter 12. The Third World. I suggested that, without books to read, life in the evenings on their Egyptian country estates must hang heavily, and that an easy chair and a good book on a cool veranda would make life much more agreeable. My friend said at once, "You don't think that a landlord in the district could sit out on a veranda after dinner with a bright light over his head, do you, and not get shot?" I might have thought of that myself. Russell Pasha, 1949. Whenever village conversation was steered to the subject of mutual help and the offer of cash loans as a part of such help to fellow villagers, it rarely failed to raise statements bemoaning the decreasing cooperation between villagers. Such statements were always accompanied with references to the fact that people in the village are becoming increasingly calculating in their approach to money matters. Villagers would then unfailingly hark back to what was termed as the old days, when people were always ready to offer aid. M. B. Abdul Rahim, 1973. 1. Decolonization and revolution dramatically transformed the political map of the globe. The number of internationally recognized independent states in Asia quintupled. In Africa, where there had been one in 1939, there were now about 50. Even in the Americas, where early 19th century decolonization had left behind 20 or so Latino republics, decolonization added another dozen. However, the important thing about them was not their number, but their enormous and growing demographic weight and pressure they represented collectively. This was the consequence of an astonishing demographic explosion in the dependent world after the Second World War, which changed and continues to change the balance of world population. Since the first industrial revolution, possibly since the 16th century, this had been moving in favour of the developed world, that is to say, of populations in or originating from Europe. From less than 20% of the global population in 1750, these had risen to constitute about one-third of humanity by 1900. The age of catastrophe froze the situation, but since the middle of the century, world population has grown at a rate beyond all precedent, and most of this has come from the regions once ruled by or about to be conquered by a handful of empires. If we take the membership of the rich countries of the OECD as representing the developed world, their collective population at the end of the 1980s represented a mere 15% of humanity, an inevitably declining share but for immigration, since several of the developed countries were no longer giving birth to enough children to reproduce themselves. This demographic explosion in the poor countries of the world, which first caused serious international worry at the end of the Golden Age, is probably the most fundamental change in the short 20th century, even if we assume that global population will be eventually stabilised at 10 billions, or whatever the current guess may be, sometime in the 21st century. A world population that doubled in the 40 years since 1950, or a population like that of Africa, which can expect to double in less than 30 years, is entirely without historical precedent, as are the practical problems it must raise. One has merely to consider the social and economic situation of a country 60% of whose people are less than 15 years old. The demographic explosion in the poor world was so sensational because the basic birth rates in these countries were usually far higher than those of the corresponding historical period in the developed countries, and because the enormous rates of mortality, which used to keep down the population, dropped like a stone since the 1940s, four or five times as fast as the corresponding drop in 19th century Europe. For, while in Europe this fall had to wait for the gradual improvement of living and environmental standards, modern technology swept through the world of the poor countries like a hurricane in the Golden Age, in the form of modern drugs and the transport revolution. From the 1940s on, medical and pharmaceutical innovation for the first time was in a position to save lives on a massive scale, for example by DDT and antibiotics, which it had previously never been able to do so, except perhaps in the case of smallpox. So as birth rates stayed high or even rose in times of prosperity, death rates plummeted. In Mexico, they dropped by more than half in the 25 years after 1944, and the population shot up, even though neither the economy nor its institutions had necessarily changed much. One incidental consequence of this was to widen the gap between the rich and poor, the advanced and backward countries, even when the economies of both regions grew at the same rate. To distribute a GDP twice as large as 30 years ago in a country whose population was stable is one thing. To distribute it among a population which, like Mexico, had doubled in 30 years is quite another. It is important to begin any account of the Third World with some consideration of its demography, since the population explosion is the central fact of its existence. Past history in the developed countries suggests that, sooner or later, it will also undergo what the experts call the demographic transition by stabilizing its population on the basis of a low birth rate and a low death rate, that is to say, of giving up having more than one or two children. However, while there is indeed evidence that the demographic transition was in the process of taking place in several countries, notably in East Asia at the end of the short 20th century, the bulk of the poor countries had not advanced very far along that road, except in the ex-Soviet bloc. This was one reason for their continued poverty. Several countries with a giant population were so troubled about the tens of millions of additional mouths that asked to be fed every year that from time to time their governments engaged in ruthless coercion to impose birth control or some other kind of family limitation on their citizens, notably the sterilization campaign in India in the 1970s and the one-child policy of China. It is unlikely that the population problem in any country will be solved by these means. 2. However, as they emerged into the post-war and post-colonial world, these were not the first concerns of the states of the poor world. What shape should they take? Not surprisingly, they adopted or were urged into political systems derived from their old imperial masters or those who had conquered them. The minority, emerging out of social revolution, or what amounted to the same thing, lengthy wars of liberation, were more likely to follow the model of the Soviet Revolution. In theory, therefore, the world was increasingly filled with what purported to be parliamentary republics with contested elections, plus a minority of People's Democratic Republics under a single guiding party. In theory, everybody henceforth was democratic, though only the communist or social revolutionary regimes insisted on being popular and or democratic in their official title. In practice, these labels indicated at most where such new states wished to situate themselves internationally. They were in general as unrealistic as the official constitutions of the Latin American republics had long tended to be, and for the same reasons. In most cases, they lacked the material and political conditions to live up to them. This was so even in the new states of the communist type, though their basically authoritarian structure and the device of a single leading party made them rather less unsuitable to states of a non-Western background than were liberal republics. Thus, one of the few unshakable and unshaken political principles of communist states was the supremacy of the civilian party over the military. Yet in the 1980s, among revolutionary-inspired states, Algeria, Benin, Burma, the Congo Republic, Ethiopia, Madagascar and Somalia, plus the somewhat eccentric Libya, were under the rule of soldiers who had come to power by coups, as were both Syria and Iraq, both under governments of the Ba'ath Socialist Party, though in rival versions. Indeed, the prevalence of, or the tendency to lapse into, military regimes united Third World states of whatever constitutional and political affiliation. If we omit the main body of Third World communist regimes, North Korea, China, the Indochinese republics and Cuba, and the long-established regime sprung from the Mexican Revolution, it is difficult to think of any republics which have not known at least episodes of military regimes since 1945. The few monarchies, with some exceptions, Thailand, seem to have been safer. India, of course, remains at the time of writing by far the most impressive example of a Third World state that has both maintained unbroken civilian supremacy and an unbroken succession of government by a regular and relatively honest popular election, though whether this justifies the label the world's greatest democracy depends on how precisely we define Lincoln's government of the people, for the people, by the people. We have become so accustomed to military coups and regimes in the world, even in Europe, that it is worth reminding ourselves that on the present scale they are a distinctly new phenomenon. In 1914, not a single internationally sovereign state had been under military rule, except in Latin America, where military coups d'état were part of tradition, and even there, at that time, the only major republic that was not under civilian rule was Mexico, which was in the middle of a revolution and civil war. There were plenty of militarist states, of states in which the military carried more than its share of political weight, and several states in which the bulk of the officer corps was out of sympathy with its government, France being an obvious example. Nevertheless, the instinct and the habit of soldiers in properly conducted and stable states was to obey and keep out of politics, or more precisely, to participate in politics only in the manner of another group of officially voiceless personages, ruling class women, namely behind the scenes and by intrigue. The politics of military coup were therefore the product of the new era of uncertain or illegitimate government. The first serious discussion of the subject, by an Italian journalist with memories of Machiavelli, Curzio Malaparte's coup d'état, appeared in 1931, halfway through the years of catastrophe. In the second half of the century, while the superpower balance appeared to stabilize frontiers and, to a lesser extent, regimes, armed men became ever more commonly involved in politics, if only because the globe was now filled up with up to 200 states, most of which were new and therefore lacked any traditional legitimacy, and most of which were saddled with political systems more likely to produce political breakdown than effective government. In such situations, the armed forces were often the only bodies capable of political or any other action on a statewide basis. Moreover, since the international Cold War between the superpowers was largely conducted through the armed forces of client or allied states, these were subsidized and armed by the appropriate superpower, or in some cases, first by one and then by the other superpower, as in Somalia. There was more scope in politics for the men in tanks than ever before. In the core countries of communism, they were kept under control by the presumption of civil supremacy through the party, although in his last lunatic years, Mao Zedong came close to abandoning it at moments. In the core countries of the Western Alliance, the scope for military politics remained restricted by the absence of political instability or the effective mechanisms for keeping it under control. Thus, after General Franco's death in Spain, a transition to liberal democracy was negotiated efficiently under the aegis of the new king, and a putsch by the unreconstructed Francoist officers in 1981 was quickly stopped in its tracks by the king's refusal to accept it. In Italy, where the USA maintained a local coup potential against the possibility of participation in government by the large local Communist Party, civilian government remained in being, even though the 1970s produced various and still unexplained flurries of action in the obscure depth of the military, secret service, and terrorist underworlds. Only where the traumas of decolonization, that is to say, defeat by colonial insurrectionaries, proved intolerable were Western officers tempted into military coups, as in France during the losing struggle to hold Indochina and Algeria in the 1950s, and, with left-wing political orientation, in Portugal as the African Empire collapsed in the 1970s. In both cases, the armed forces were soon brought under civilian control again. The only military regime actually backed by the USA in Europe was that installed in 1967, probably on local initiative, by a particularly witless group of ultra-right-wing Greek colonels in a country where civil war between communists and their opponents, 1944 to 1949, had left bitter memories on both sides. The regime, distinguished by a taste for the systematic torture of its opponents, collapsed after 7 years under the weight of its own political stupidity. Conditions for military intervention in the Third World were far more inviting, especially in new, feeble, and often tiny states where a few hundred armed men, reinforced or sometimes even replaced by foreigners, could carry decisive weight, and where inexperienced or incompetent governments were quite likely to produce recurrent states of chaos, corruption, and confusion. The typical military ruler in most African countries was not an aspirant dictator, but someone genuinely trying to clear up such messes, hoping, too often in vain, that civilian government would soon take over again. Generally, he failed in both endeavours, which is why few military chieftains lasted very long. In any case, the slightest hint that local government might fall into the hands of the communists virtually guaranteed American support. In short, military politics, like military intelligence, tended to fill the void left by the absence of ordinary politics or intelligence. It was not any particular brand of politics, but a function of the surrounding instability and insecurity. However, it became increasingly pervasive in the Third World because virtually all the countries of the ex-colonial or dependent parts of the globe were now committed, in one way or another, to policies which required them to have exactly those stable, functioning, and efficient states which so few of them had. They were committed to economic independence and development. In the aftermath of the second round of world war, world revolution and its consequence, global decolonization, it seemed that there was no future for the old program of prosperity as primary producers for the world market of the imperialist countries. The program of the Argentine and Uruguayan estancieros, hopefully imitated by Mexico's Porfirio Diaz and Peru's Leguia. In any case, it had ceased to look plausible since the Great Slump. Moreover, both nationalism and anti-imperialism called for politics less dependent on the old empires, and the example of the USSR provided an alternative model or development. Never did that example look more impressive than in the years after 1945. The more ambitious states therefore called for an end to agrarian backwardness by systematic industrialization, whether on the centrally planned Soviet model or by import substitution. Both, in different ways, rested on state action and state control. Even the less ambitious, who did not dream of a future of great tropical steelworks powered by huge hydroelectric installations overshadowed by titanic dams, wanted to control and develop their own national resources themselves. Oil had been traditionally produced by private Western corporations, usually with the closest relations to imperial powers. Governments, following the example of Mexico in 1938, now took to nationalizing them and operating them as state enterprises. Those which refrained from nationalization discovered, especially after 1950, when Aramco offered Saudi Arabia the hitherto unimaginable deal of a 50-50 revenue split, that physical possession of oil and gas gave them the whip hand in negotiations with the foreign corporations. In practice, the Organization of Petrol Exporting Countries, OPEC, which eventually held the world to ransom in the 1970s, became possible because the ownership of the world's oil had shifted from companies to a relatively few producer governments. In short, even those governments of decolonized or dependent states which were quite happy with relying on foreign capitalists, old or new, neo-colonialism in contemporary left-wing terminology, did so within a state-controlled economy. Probably the most successful of such states until the 1980s was the former French Ivory Coast. Probably the least successful were new countries which underestimated the constraints of backwardness, lack of skilled and experienced experts, administrators and economic cadres, illiteracy, unfamiliarity or lack of sympathy with programs of economic modernization, especially when their governments set themselves targets which even developed countries found difficult, such as centrally state-planned industrialization. Ghana, with Sudan, the first sub-Saharan African state to be granted independence, thus threw away currency reserves of 200 million, accumulated thanks to high cocoa prices and wartime earnings, higher than the sterling balances of independent India, in an attempt to build an industrialized state-controlled economy, not to mention Kwame Nkrumah's plans for Pan-African Union. The results were disastrous and made worse by the collapse of cocoa prices in the 1960s. By 1972, the great projects had failed. The domestic industries in the small country could survive only behind high tariff walls, price controls and import licenses, which led to a flourishing black economy and generalized corruption that has remained ineradicable. 3/4 of all wage earners were employed in the public sector, while subsistence agriculture, as in so many other African states, was neglected. After Nkrumah's overthrow by the usual military coup, 1966, the country continued on its disillusioned way amid a succession of usually disappointed military and occasionally civilian governments. The dismal record of sub-Saharan Africa's new states should not lead us to underestimate the substantial achievements of better-placed ex-colonial or dependent colonies, who chose the road of state-planned or state-sponsored economic development. What came to be known from the 1970s in international functionaries' jargon as the NICs, newly industrializing countries, were all, with the exception of the city-state of Hong Kong, based on such policies. As anyone with the slightest knowledge of Brazil and Mexico will testify, they produced bureaucracy, spectacular corruption, and much waste, but also a 7% annual rate of growth in both countries for decades. In short, both achieved the desired transition to modern industrial economies. In fact, Brazil became for a time the 8th largest industrial economy of the non-communist world. Both countries had a sufficiently vast population to provide a substantial home market, so that industrialization by import substitution made sense, at least for quite a long time. Public spending and activities sustained high demand at home. At one time, the Brazilian public sector handled about half the gross domestic product and represented 19 out of the 20 largest companies, while in Mexico it employed a fifth of the total workforce and paid two-fifths of the national wage bill. State planning in the Far East tended to rely less on direct public enterprise and more on favored business groups dominated by government control of credit and investment, but the dependence of economic development on the state was the same. Planning and state initiative was the name of the game everywhere in the world in the 1950s and 1960s, and in the NICs until the 1990s. Whether this form of economic development produced satisfactory or disappointing results depended on local conditions and human errors. 3. Development, state-controlled or not, was not of immediate interest to the great majority of the inhabitants of the Third World who lived by growing their own food. For even in countries or colonies whose public revenues relied on the income from one or two major export crops, coffee, bananas or cocoa, these were usually concentrated in a few restricted areas. In sub-Saharan Africa and most of South and Southeast Asia, as well as in China, the mass of people continued to live by agriculture. Only in the Western Hemisphere and in the dry lands of Western Islam did the countryside as yet drain into the giant cities, turning rural into urban societies in a couple of dramatic decades. In fertile and not too densely populated regions, like much of Black Africa, most people would have managed pretty well if left to themselves. Most of its inhabitants did not need their states, which were usually too weak to do much harm, and if they grew too troublesome, could probably be bypassed by a retreat into village self-sufficiency. Few continents started the era of independence with greater advantages, which were soon to be thrown away. Most Asian and Islamic peasants were much poorer, or at least worst fed, sometimes, as in India, desperately and historically poor. And the pressure of men and women on limited lands was already more severe. Nevertheless, it seemed to a good many of them that the best solution to their problems was not to get involved with those who told them that economic development would bring untold wealth and prosperity, but to keep them at bay. Long experience had shown them and their ancestors before them that no good came from outside. Generations of silent calculation had taught them that minimizing risks was a better policy than maximizing profits. This did not keep them entirely outside the ambit of a global economic revolution, which reached even the more isolated among them in the form of plastic sandals, petrol cans, ancient trucks, and, of course, government offices with pieces of paper in them. But it tended to divide humanity in such areas into those who operated in and through the world of writing and offices and the rest. In most of the rural Third World, the central distinction was between coast and interior, or city and backwards. The trouble was that since modernity and government went together, the interior was governed by the coast, the backwards by the city, the illiterate by the educated. In the beginning was the word. The House of Assembly of what would shortly become the independent state of Ghana included among its 104 members 68 who had had some form of post-primary education. The 106 members of the Legislative Assembly for the Telangana, South India, contained 97 with secondary or higher education, including 50 graduates. In both these regions, the great majority of the inhabitants at the time were illiterate. What is more, anyone wishing to be active in the national government of third world states needed to be literate not only in the common language of the region, which was not necessarily that of his or her community, but in one of the small number of international languages, English, French, Spanish, Arabic, Mandarin Chinese, or at least the regional lingua franca, which new governments tended to develop into written national languages, Swahili, Bahasa, Pidgin. The only exception was in those parts of Latin America where the written official languages, Spanish and Portuguese, coincided with the spoken language of the majority. Out of the candidates for public office in Hyderabad, India, in the general election of 1967, only 3 out of 34 spoke no English. Even the more remote and backward people, therefore, increasingly recognized the advantages of superior education, even when they could not themselves share them, perhaps especially when they could not. In a literal sense, knowledge meant power, most obviously in countries where the state appeared to its subjects to be a machine that extracted their resources and then distributed these resources to state employees. Education meant a post, often a guaranteed post, in the public service, with luck a career, which enabled men to extract bribes and commissions and to provide jobs for family and friends. A village in, say, Central Africa, which invested in the education of one of its young men, hoped for a return in the form of income and protection for the whole community from the government post which education would guarantee. In any case, the successful civil servant was the best-paid man in the population. In a country like Uganda in the 1960s, he could expect a legal salary 112 times the average per capita income of his countrymen, as against a comparable ratio of 10 to 1 in Great Britain. Where it seemed that poor people from the countryside might themselves share in the advantages of education or provide them for their children, as in Latin America, the third world region closest to modernity and most distant from colonialism, the desire to learn was virtually universal. They all want to learn something, a Chilean communist organizer among the Mapuche Indians told the author in 1962. I'm not an intellectual and I can't teach them school knowledge, so I teach them how to play football. This thirst for knowledge explains much of the amazing mass migration from village to city which emptied the countryside of the South American continent from the 1950s on. For all inquiries concur that the attraction of the city lay not least in the better chances of education and training for the children. There they could become something else. Schooling naturally opened the best prospects, but in backward agrarian regions, even so simple a skill as being able to drive a motor vehicle could be the key to a better life. It was the first thing that an emigrant from a Quechua village in the Andes taught the cousins and nephews from home who joined him in the city, hoping to make their own way into the modern world. For had not his employment as an ambulance driver proved to be the foundation of his own family's success? Probably it was not until the 1960s or later that rural people outside parts of Latin America began systematically to see modernity as a promise rather than a threat. And yet there was one aspect of the policy of economic development which might have been expected to appeal to them, since it directly affected the 3/5 or more of human beings who lived by agriculture: land reform. This general slogan of politics in agrarian countries might cover anything from the breakup of large landholdings and their redistribution to peasants and landless labourers, to the abolition of feudal tenures or servitudes, rent reduction and tenancy reforms of various kinds, to revolutionary land nationalisation and collectivisation. There has probably never been more of it than in the decade after the end of the Second World War, for it was practised along the entire spectrum of politics. Between 1945 and 1950, almost half of the human race found themselves living in countries undergoing some kind of land reform, of the communist type in Eastern Europe and, after 1949, China, as a consequence of decolonization in the former British Indian Empire and as a consequence of Japan's defeat, or rather American occupation policy, in Japan, Taiwan and Korea. The Egyptian Revolution of 1952 extended its range to the Western Islamic world. Iraq, Syria and Algeria followed the Cairo example. The Bolivian Revolution of 1952 introduced it into South America, though Mexico since the Revolution of 1910, or more precisely since its revival in the 1930s, had long championed agrarismo. Still, in spite of an increasing flood of political declarations and statistical inquiry on the subject, Latin America had too few revolutions, decolonizations, or lost wars to have much actual land reform until Fidel Castro's Cuban Revolution, which introduced it on that island, put the matter on the political agenda. For the modernizers, the case for land reform was political, gaining peasant support for revolutionary regimes or for those which could preempt revolution or the like, ideological, giving the land back to the toilers, for example, and sometimes economic, although most revolutionaries or reformers did not expect too much from a mere distribution of land to a traditional peasantry and the landless or land poor. Indeed, farm output fell drastically in Bolivia and Iraq immediately after these countries' respective land reforms in 1952 and 1958, though in fairness, one should add that where peasant skill and productivity were already high, land reform could quickly release a great deal of productive potential hitherto held in reserve by sceptical villagers, as in Egypt, Japan, and most strikingly Taiwan. The case for maintaining a large peasantry in being was and is non-economic, since in the history of the modern world, the enormous rise in agrarian output has gone together with an equally spectacular decline in the number and proportion of agriculturalists, most dramatically so since the Second World War. Land reform could and did, however, demonstrate that peasant farming, especially by larger, modern-minded farmers, could be as efficient as and more flexible than the traditional landed estate, the imperialist plantation, and, indeed, ill-judged modern attempts to conduct agriculture on a quasi-industrial basis, such as Soviet-type giant state farms and the British scheme for producing groundnuts in Tanganyika, the present Tanzania, after 1945. Crops like coffee or even sugar and rubber, once thought of as essentially plantation-produced, are so no longer, even if the plantation still maintains a clear advantage over small-scale and unskilled producers in some cases. Still, the major advances of third-world agriculture since the war, the Green Revolution, of new scientifically selected crops, have been achieved by business-minded farmers as in the Punjab. However, the strongest economic case for land reform rests not on productivity, but on equality. On the whole, economic development has tended first to increase and later to diminish the inequality of national income distribution over the long haul, although economic decline and a theological belief in the free market have lately begun to reverse this here and there. Equality at the end of the Golden Age was greater in the developed Western countries than in the Third World. Yet while income inequality was at its highest in Latin America, followed by Africa, it was unusually low in a number of Asian countries, where a very radical land reform had been imposed under the auspices or by the American occupying forces, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. None, however, were as egalitarian as the socialist countries of Eastern Europe or, at the time, Australia. Observers of the industrializing triumphs of these countries have naturally speculated how far they have been assisted by the social or economic advantages of this situation, just as observers of the much more fitful advance of the Brazilian economy, always on the verge of but never achieving its destiny as the USA of the Southern Hemisphere, have wondered how far it has been held back by the spectacular inequality of its income distribution, which inevitably restricts the domestic market for industry. Indeed, the striking social inequality of Latin America can hardly be unconnected with the equally striking absence of systematic agrarian reform from so many of its countries. Land reform was undoubtedly welcomed by the peasantry of the Third World, at least until it was transformed into collective farming or cooperative production, as it usually was in communist countries. However, what the modernizers saw in it was not what it meant to the peasants, who were uninterested in macroeconomic problems, who saw national politics in a different perspective from the city reformers, and whose demand for land was not based on general principle but on specific claims. Thus, the radical land reform instituted by a government of reformist generals in Peru in 1969, which destroyed the country's system of large estates, haciendas, at one blow, failed for this reason. For the Indian highland communities, which had lived in unstable coexistence with the vast Andean livestock ranches to whom they supplied labour, Reform simply meant the just return to the native communities of the common lands and pastures once alienated from them by the landlords, whose boundaries were accurately remembered over the centuries and whose loss they had never accepted. They were not interested in the maintenance of the old enterprise as a productive unit now under the ownership of the comunidades and its former workforce in cooperative experiments or in other agrarian novelties other than the traditional mutual aid within the far-from-egalitarian community. After the reform, the communities went back to invading the lands of the cooperativized estates, of which they were now co-proprietors, as though nothing had changed in the conflict between estate and community, and between communities in dispute about their lands. As far as they were concerned, nothing had changed. The land reform closest to the peasant ideal was probably the Mexican one of the 1930s, which gave the common land inalienably to village communities to organize as they wished, ejidos, and assumed peasants were engaged in subsistence agriculture. It was a huge political success, but economically irrelevant to subsequent Mexican agrarian developments. 4. It is not surprising that the dozens of post-colonial states which emerged after the Second World War, together with most of Latin America, which also plainly belonged to the regions dependent on the old imperial and industrial world, soon found themselves grouped together as the Third World, the term is said to have been coined in 1952, by contrast with the First World of the developed capitalist countries and the Second World of the communist ones. In spite of the evident absurdity of treating Egypt and Gabon, India and Papua New Guinea as societies of the same kind, this was not wholly implausible, inasmuch as all were poor compared to the developed world, all were dependent, all had governments that wanted to develop, and none believed in the aftermath of the Great Slump and the Second World War that the capitalist world market, that is to say, the economists' doctrine of comparative advantage or spontaneous private enterprise at home, would achieve this end. Moreover, as the iron grill of the Cold War was clamped across the globe, all who had any freedom of action wanted to avoid joining either of the two alliance systems, that is to say, to keep out of the Third World War, which everyone feared. This does not mean that the non-aligned were equally opposed to both sides in the Cold War. The inspirers and champions of the movement, usually called after its first international conference in 1955 at Bandung in Indonesia, were radical colonial ex-revolutionaries, Jawaharlal Nehru of India, Sukarno of Indonesia, Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, and a dissident communist, President Tito of Yugoslavia. All these, like so many of the ex-colonial regimes, were or claimed to be socialist in their own, that is to say, non-Soviet way, including the Royal Buddhist Socialism of Cambodia. All had some sympathies for the Soviet Union, or were at least ready to accept economic and military help from it, not surprisingly, since the United States had abandoned its old anti-colonial traditions at a moment's notice after the world divided and visibly looked for support among the most conservative elements of the Third World, Iraq before the 1958 revolution, Turkey, Pakistan, and the Shah's Iran, which formed the Central Treaty Organization, CENTO. Pakistan, the Philippines, and Thailand in the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, SEATO, both designed to complete the anti-Soviet military system whose main pillar was NATO. Neither amounted to much. When the essentially Afro-Asian non-aligned group became tri-continental after the Cuban Revolution of 1959, its Latin American members not surprisingly came from the republics of the Western Hemisphere least sympathetic to the Big Brother of the North. Nevertheless, unlike the US sympathizers in the Third World who might actually join the Western alliance system, the non-communist Bandung states had no intention of being involved in a global superpower confrontation, since as the Korean and the Vietnam War and the Cuban Missile Crisis proved, they were the perpetual potential front line in such a conflict. The more the actual European border between the two camps was stabilized, the more likely, if the guns were to fire, the bombs to drop, it would be in some Asian mountains or African bush. Yet, though the superpower confrontation dominated, and to some extent stabilized, interstate relations worldwide, it did not entirely control them. There were two regions in which indigenous Third World tensions, essentially unconnected with the Cold War, created permanent conditions for conflict which periodically erupted in war: the Middle East and the northern part of the Indian subcontinent. Both, not by chance, were the heirs to imperial schemes of partition. The latter conflict zone was more easily insulated from the global Cold War, in spite of Pakistan's attempts to involve the Americans, which failed until the Afghan War of the 1980s. Hence the West heard little, and remembers even less, of the three regional wars: the Sino-Indian War of 1962, over the ill-defined border between the two countries, won by China; the Indo-Pakistan War of 1965, handily won by India; and the second Indo-Pakistan conflict of 1971, arising out of the breakaway of East Pakistan, Bangladesh, which India supported. USA and USSR tried to act as benevolent neutrals and mediators. The situation in the Middle East could not be so isolated, because several of America's allies were directly involved: Israel, Turkey, and the Shah's Iran. Moreover, as the succession of local revolutions, military and civilian, proved, from Egypt in 1952 via Iraq and Syria in the 1950s and 1960s, South Arabia in the 1960s and 1970s, to Iran itself in 1979, the region was, and remains, socially unstable. These regional conflicts had no essential connection with the Cold War. The USSR had been among the first to recognize the new state of Israel, which later established itself as the main ally of the USA, and the Arab or other Islamic states, right or left, were united in repressing communism within their frontiers. The main force of disruption was Israel, where the Jewish settlers built a larger Jewish state than had been envisaged under the British partition, driving out 700,000 non-Jewish Palestinians, perhaps a larger number than the Jewish population in 1948, fighting one war per decade for the purpose: 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, 1982. In the course of these wars, which can best be compared with the wars fought by the Prussian King Frederick II in the 18th century to win recognition for his possession of Silesia, which he had robbed from his neighbour, Austria, Israel also turned itself into the most formidable military force in the region and acquired nuclear arms, but failed to establish a stable basis of relations with its neighbour states, let alone with the permanently embittered Palestinians within its extended frontiers or in the diaspora of the Middle East. The collapse of the USSR removed the Middle East from the front line of the Cold War, but left it as explosive as before. Three lesser centres of conflict helped to keep it so: the Eastern Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf, and the border region between Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, where the Kurds attempted vainly to win the national independence, which President Wilson had incautiously urged them to demand in 1918. Unable to find a permanent backer among the powerful states, they disturbed the relations between all their neighbours, who massacred them by all available means, including in the 1980s poison gas, insofar as not resisted by the proverbial skill of the Kurds as mountain guerrilla fighters. The Eastern Mediterranean remained relatively quiet, since both Greece and Turkey were members of NATO, even though the conflict between the two led to a Turkish invasion of Cyprus, which was partitioned in 1974. On the other hand, the rivalry between the Western powers, Iraq and Iran, for positions in the Persian Gulf was to lead to the savage 8-year war between Iraq and revolutionary Iran, 1980-1988, and after the end of the Cold War, between the USA and its allies and Iraq in 1991. One part of the Third World remained fairly remote from both global and local international conflicts until after the Cuban Revolution: Latin America. Except for small patches on the mainland, the Guyanas, Belize, then known as British Honduras, and the smaller islands of the Caribbean, it had been decolonized long ago. Culturally and linguistically, its populations were Western, inasmuch as the great bulk of even its poor inhabitants were Roman Catholics, and, but for some areas of the Andes and continental Central America, spoke or understood a culture language shared by Europeans. While the region had inherited an elaborate racial hierarchy from the Iberian conquerors, it also inherited from an overwhelmingly male conquest a tradition of massive miscegenation. There were few genuine whites, except in the southern cone of South America, Argentina, Uruguay, southern Brazil, populated by European mass immigration, where there were very few natives. In both cases, achievement and social status cancelled out race. Mexico elected a recognizably Zapotec Indian, Benito Juarez, as president as early as 1861. At the time of writing, Argentina has as president a Lebanese Muslim immigrant and Peru a Japanese immigrant. Both choices were still unthinkable in the USA. To this day, Latin America still remains outside the vicious circle of ethnic politics and ethnic nationalism which ravages the other continents. Moreover, while most of the continent clearly recognized itself to be what was now called a neo-colonial dependency on a single dominant imperial power, the USA was realistic enough not to send gunboats and marines into the larger states. It did not hesitate to use them against the small ones, and the Latin governments from the Rio Grande to Cape Horn knew perfectly well that the wise thing was to keep on the right side of Washington. The Organization of American States, OAS, founded in 1948, its headquarters in Washington, was not a body inclined to disagree with the USA. When Cuba made its revolution, the OAS expelled it. 5. And yet, at the very moment when the Third World and the ideologies based on it were at their peak, the concept began to crumble. In the 1970s, it became increasingly evident that no single name or label could adequately cover a set of increasingly divergent countries. The term was still convenient to distinguish poor countries of the world from the rich, and insofar as the gap between the two zones, often now called the North and the South, was visibly widening, there was much point to the distinction. The gap in per capita GNP between the developed and the backward world, that is to say the OECD countries and the low and middle economies, continued to widen. The first group averaged 14.5 times the GNP per capita of the second in 1970, but over 24 times the poor country's GNP per capita in 1990. However, the Third World is demonstrably no longer a single entity. What split it was primarily economic development. The triumph of OPEC in 1973 produced for the first time a body of Third World states, mostly backward by any criteria and hitherto poor, which now emerged as world-scale supermillionaires, especially when they consisted of smallish, thinly inhabited stretches of sand or forest, ruled by usually Muslim sheikhs or sultans. It was plainly impossible to class, say, the United Arab Emirates, each of whose 500,000 inhabitants, 1975, had in theory a share of the GNP worth over $13,000, almost double the GNP per capita of the USA at this time, in the same pigeonhole as, say, Pakistan, which then enjoyed a GNP per capita of $130. Oil states with a large population did not do so well, but it nevertheless became evident that states dependent on the export of a single primary commodity, however disadvantaged in other respects, could become extremely rich, even if this easy money also almost invariably tempted them into throwing it out of the window. By the early 1990s, even Saudi Arabia had managed to run into debt. In the second place, part of the Third World was visibly and rapidly becoming industrialized and joining the First World, even though it remained much poorer. South Korea, as spectacular an industrial success story as any in history, had a GNP per capita, 1989, barely higher than that of Portugal, the poorest by far of the members of the European community. Once again, qualitative differences apart, South Korea is no longer comparable with, say, Papua New Guinea, although the GNP per capita of the two countries was exactly the same in 1969 and remained of the same order of magnitude until the middle of the 1970s. It is now about five times as large. As we have seen, a new category, the NICs, entered the international jargon. There was no precise definition, but practically all lists included the four Pacific tigers, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan and South Korea, India, Brazil and Mexico. But the process of Third World industrialization is such that Malaya and the Philippines, Colombia, Pakistan and Thailand, as well as some others, have also been included. Actually, a category of new and rapid industrializers crosses the borders of the three worlds, for strictly it should also include such industrialized market economies, that is to say, capitalist countries as Spain and Finland, and most of the ex-socialist states of Eastern Europe, not to mention, since the late 1970s, communist China. In fact, in the 1970s, observers began to draw attention to a new international division of labour, that is to say, a massive shift of industries producing for the world market from the first generation of industrial economies, which had previously monopolized them, to other parts of the world. This was partly due to the deliberate transfer by firms from the old industrial world of part or all of their production or supplies to the second and third worlds, eventually followed by some transfers of even very sophisticated processes in high-tech industries, such as research and development. The revolution in modern transport and communications made genuinely worldwide production both possible and economic. It was also due to the deliberate efforts of third world governments to industrialize by conquering export markets, if need be, but preferably not, at the expense of the old protection of home markets. This economic globalization, which can be verified by anyone who checks the national origins of products sold in any North American shopping mall, developed slowly in the 1960s and accelerated strikingly during the decades of the world's economic troubles after 1973. How rapidly it advanced may once again be illustrated by South Korea, which at the end of the 1950s still had almost 80% of its working population in agriculture, from which it derived almost three-quarters of its national income. It inaugurated the first of its five-year development plans in 1962. By the late 1980s, it got only 10% of its GDP from agriculture and had become the eighth-largest industrial economy of the non-communist world. In the third place, a number of countries emerged, or rather were submerged, at the bottom of the international statistics, which even international euphemism found it difficult to describe simply as developing, since they were plainly both poor and increasingly lagging. A subgroup of low-income developing countries was tactfully established to distinguish the 3 billion human beings whose GNP per capita, had they received it, would have worked out at an average of $330 in 1989 from the 500 luckier millions in less destitute countries like the Dominican Republic, Ecuador and Guatemala, whose average GNP was about three times as high, and the even more luxurious members of the next group, Brazil, Malaysia, Mexico and the like, which averaged about eight times as much. The 800 or so millions in the most prosperous group enjoyed a theoretical GNP allocation per head of $18,280, or 55 times as much as the bottom three-fifths of humanity. In effect, as the world economy became genuinely global, and especially after the fall of the Soviet region, more purely capitalist and business-dominated investors and entrepreneurs discovered that large parts of it were of no profitable interest to them, unless perhaps they could bribe its politicians and civil servants into wasting the money extracted from their unfortunate citizens on armaments or prestige projects. A disproportionately large number of these countries were to be found in the unhappy continent of Africa. The end of the Cold War deprived such states of the economic, that is to say, largely military aid, which had turned some of them, like Somalia, into armed camps and eventual battlefields. Moreover, as divisions among the poor increased, so globalization brought movements, most obviously of human beings, that crossed the dividing lines between regions and classifications. From the rich countries, tourists flowed into the third world as never before. In the middle of the 1980s, 1985, to take only some Muslim countries, the 16 millions of Malaysia received 3 million tourists per year, the 7 million Tunisians, 2 millions, the 3 million Jordanians, 2 millions. From the poor countries, the streams of labour migration into the rich swelled into huge torrents, insofar as they were not dammed back by political barriers. By 1968, migrants from the Maghreb, Tunisia, Morocco, and above all Algeria, already formed almost a quarter of all foreigners in France. In 1975, 5.5% of the Algerian population emigrated. And one-third of all immigrants to the USA came from Latin America, at that time still overwhelmingly from Central America. nor did this migration move only towards the old industrial countries. The number of foreign workers in the oil-producing states in the Middle East and Libya shot up from 1.8 to 2.8 million in a mere 5 years, 1975 to 1980. Most of them came from the region, but a large body came from South Asia and even further afield. Unfortunately, in the grim 1970s and 1980s, labour migration became increasingly hard to separate from the torrents of men, women and children who fled from or were uprooted by famine, political or ethnic persecution, war and civil war, thus facing the countries of the First World, equally committed in theory to helping refugees and, in practice, to preventing immigration from poor countries, with severe problems of political and legal casuistry. With the exception of the USA and, to a lesser extent, Canada and Australia, which encouraged or permitted mass immigration from the Third World, they opted to keep them out under the pressure of a growing xenophobia among their native populations. 6. The astonishing great leap forward of the capitalist world economy and its growing globalization not only divided and disrupted the concept of a third world, it also brought virtually all its inhabitants consciously into the modern world. They did not necessarily like it. Indeed, many fundamentalist and other nominally traditionalist movements, which now gained ground in several third world countries, especially but not exclusively in the Islamic region, were specifically revolts against modernity, though this is certainly not true of all movements to which this imprecise label is attached. But they knew themselves to be part of a world which was not like their fathers. It came to them in the form of the dusty backroads, bus or truck, the petrol pump, the battery-powered transistor radio, which brought the world to them, perhaps even to the illiterates in their own unwritten dialect or language, though this was probably the privilege of the urban immigrant. But in a world where country people migrated to the cities in their millions, and even in rural African countries with urban populations of a third or more becoming common, Nigeria, Zaire, Tanzania, Senegal, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Chad, Central African Republic, Gabon, Benin, Zambia, Congo, Somalia, Liberia, almost everybody had worked in the city or had a relative who lived there. Village and city were henceforth interwoven. Even the most remote now lived in a world of plastic sheeting, Coca-Cola bottles, cheap digital watches and artificial fibres. By a strange inversion of history, the back country of the Third World even began to commercialise its skills in the First World. On city street corners of Europe, small groups of peripatetic Indians from the South American Andes played their melancholy flutes, and on the pavements of New York, Paris and Rome, black peddlers from West Africa sold trinkets to the natives as the natives' ancestors had done on their trading voyages to the Dark Continent. Almost certainly, the big city was the crucible of change, if only because it was modern by definition. In Lima, as an upwardly mobile migrant from the Andes used to tell his children, there's more progress, there's much more stimulation, más roje. However much the migrants used the toolkit of traditional society to construct their urban existence, building and structuring the new shantytowns like the old rural communities, too much in the city was novel and unprecedented. Too many of its mores conflicted with those of the olden days. Nowhere was this more dramatic than in the expected behaviour of young women, whose break with tradition was deplored from Africa to Peru. In a traditional Huanyo song from Lima, La Gringa, an immigrant boy complains, "When you came from your homeland, you came as a country girl. Now you are in Lima, you comb your hair in a city way. You even say, 'Wait, please, I'm going to dance the twist.' Don't be pretentious, be less proud. Between your hair and my hair, there is no difference." Yet from the city, the consciousness of modernity spread to the countryside, even where rural life was not itself transformed by new crops, new technology, and new forms of organisation and marketing, through the dramatic green revolution of grain crop farming by scientifically designed crop varieties in parts of Asia, which spread from the 1960s on, or a little later, by the development of new export crops for the world market, made possible both by the mass air freighting of perishables, tropical fruit, flowers, and new consumer tastes in the developed world, cocaine. The effect of such rural changes is not to be underestimated. Nowhere did the old ways and the new come into more frontal collision than on the Amazonian frontier of Colombia, which in the 1970s became a staging post for the transport of Bolivian and Peruvian coca and the location of the laboratories processing it into cocaine. This happened a few years after it had been settled by peasant frontier colonists escaping from state and landlords, and who were defended by those recognized protectors of the peasant way of life, the communist guerrillas of the FARC. Here the market, in its most ruthless form, clashed with those who lived by subsistence farming and what men could get with a gun, a dog, and a fishing net. How could a patch of yucca and bananas compete against the temptation to cultivate a crop commanding bonanza prices, even though unstable ones, and the old way of life against the airstrips and boomtown settlements of the drug makers and traffickers and their freewheeling gunmen, bars and brothels? The countryside was indeed being transformed, but even its transformations depended on the city civilization and its industries, for often enough its very economy depended on the earnings of the emigrants, as in the so-called black homelands of apartheid South Africa, which generated only 10-15% of their inhabitants' income, the remainder coming from the earnings of migrant workers in the white territories. Paradoxically, in the Third World, as in parts of the First, the city could become the saviour of a rural economy, which, but for its impact, might have been abandoned by people who had learned from migrant experience, their own or their neighbours, that men and women had alternatives. They discovered that it was not inevitable that they should slave a lifetime away, scratching a wretched livelihood from marginal, exhausted and stony land, as their ancestors had done. Plenty of rural settlements across the globe, in romantic and therefore agriculturally marginal landscapes, were emptied of all except the elderly from the 1960s on. Yet a highland community whose emigrants discovered a niche in the economy of the big city which they could occupy, in this case selling fruit, or more precisely, strawberries in Lima, could maintain or revitalize its pastoral character by a shift from farm income to non-farm income, operating through a complicated symbiosis of migrant and resident households. It is perhaps significant that in this particular case, which has been unusually well studied, the migrants rarely became workers. They chose to fit into the great network of the Third World informal economy as petty traders. For the major social change in the Third World was probably that carried by the new and growing middle and lower middle classes of migrants engaged in some method, or more likely multiple methods, of earning money, and the major form of its economic life was, especially in the poorest countries, the informal economy which escaped official statistics. So sometime in the last third of the century, the wide trench that separated the small modernizing or westernized ruling minorities of Third World countries from the mass of their peoples began to be filled by the general transformation of their societies. We do not yet know how or when this happened, or what forms the new consciousness of this transformation took, for most of these countries still lacked even adequate government statistical services, or the machinery of market and public opinion research, or the academic social science departments with research students to keep busy. In any case, what happens at the grassroots of societies is difficult to discover even in the best documented countries until it has happened, which is why the early stages of new social and cultural fashions among the young are unpredictable, unpredicted, and often unrecognized, even by those who live by making money out of them, like the popular culture industry, let alone by the parental generation. Yet clearly something was stirring in Third World cities below the level of elite consciousness, even in an apparently completely stagnant country like the Belgian Congo, now Zaire, for how else can we explain that the type of popular music developed there in the inert 1950s became the most influential in Africa in the 1960s and 1970s? For that matter, how can we explain the rise of political consciousness which causes the Belgians to send the Congo off to independence in 1960, virtually at a moment's notice, though until then this colony, almost equally hostile to native education as to native political activity, looked, to most observers, as likely to remain as shut off from the rest of the world as Japan before the Meiji Restoration? Whatever the stirrings in the 1950s, by the 1960s and 1970s, the signs of major social transformation were quite evident in the Western Hemisphere and undeniable in the Islamic world and the major countries of South and Southeast Asia. Paradoxically, they were probably least visible in the parts of the socialist world which corresponded to the Third World, for example, in Soviet Central Asia and the Caucasus. For it is not often recognized that communist revolution was an engine of conservation. While it set out to transform a specified number of aspects of life, state power, property relations, economic structure and the like, it froze others in their pre-revolutionary shapes, or at any rate protected them against the universal continuous subversion of change in capitalist societies. In any case, its strongest weapon, sheer state power, was less effective at transforming human behavior than either the positive rhetoric about the new socialist man or the negative rhetoric about totalitarianism like to think. Uzbeks and Tajiks, who lived north of the Soviet-Afghan border, were almost certainly more literate and more secularized and better off than those who lived south of it, but they may not have differed as much in their mores as 70 years of socialism would have led one to expect. Blood feud was probably not a major preoccupation of the authorities in the Caucasus since the 1930s, though during collectivization, the death of a man in a Kolkhoz threshing machine accident led to a feud which entered the annals of Soviet jurisprudence. But in the early 1990s, observers warned of the danger of national self-extermination in Chechnya, since the majority of the Chechen families have been dragged into a vendetta-type relationship. The cultural consequences of this social transformation await the historian. They cannot be considered here, though it is clear that, even in very traditional societies, the network of mutual obligation and customs came under increasing strain. The extended family in Ghana and across Africa, it was observed, functions under immense stress, like a bridge that has borne too much high-speed traffic for too many years. Its foundations are cracking. The rural old and the urban young are separated by hundreds of miles of bad roads and centuries of development. Politically, it is easier to assess the paradoxical consequences, for with the entry of the masses of the population, or at least the young and city people, into a modern world, the monopoly of the small, westernized elites who shaped the first generation of post-colonial history was being challenged, and with them the programs, the ideologies, the very vocabulary and syntax of the public discourse on which the new states rested. For the new urban and urbanized masses, even the new massive middle classes, however educated, were not, and by virtue of sheer numbers, could not be the old elites, whose members could hold their own with the colonialists or with their fellow graduates from European or American schools. Often, this was very obvious in South Asia, they resented them. In any case, the masses of the poor did not share the belief in the Western 19th century aspiration of secular progress. In the Western Islamic countries, the conflict between the old secular leaders and the new Islamic mass democracy became patent and explosive. From Algeria to Turkey, the values which, in the countries of Western liberalism, are associated with constitutional government and the rule of law, as, for instance, the rights of women, were being protected, insofar as they existed, against democracy by the military force of the liberators of their nations or their heirs. The conflict was not confined to Islamic countries, nor the reaction against the old values of progress to the masses of the poor. The Hindu exclusivism of the BJP party in India had substantial support among the new business and middle classes. The impassioned and savage ethno-religious nationalism, which in the 1980s turned peaceful Sri Lanka into a killing field comparable only to El Salvador, occurred unexpectedly in a prosperous Buddhist country. It was rooted in two social transformations: the profound identity crisis of villages whose social order had gone to pieces, and the rise of a mass stratum of better educated youth. Villages transmuted by in and out migration, divided by the widening differences between rich and poor that the cash economy brought, racked with the instability brought by the unevenness of an education-based social mobility, the fading of the physical and linguistic markers of caste and status which separated people but also left no doubt about their positions, these inevitably lived in anxiety about their community. This has been used to explain, among other things, the appearance of novel symbols and rituals of a togetherness which was itself novel, such as the sudden development of congregational forms of Buddhist worship in the 1970s, replacing older private and household forms of devotion, or the institution of school sports days opened with the national anthem played on borrowed tape cassettes. These were the politics of a changing and inflammable world. What made them less predictable was that in many countries of the Third World, nationwide politics, in the sense invented and recognised in the West since the French Revolution, had never existed or had not been allowed to function. Where there was a long tradition of politics with some kind of mass roots, or even a substantial acceptance among the passive citizens of the legitimacy of the political classes who conducted their affairs, a degree of continuity could be maintained. Colombians, as readers of García Márquez know, continued to be born little liberals or little conservatives as they had for more than a century, though they might change the content of the bottles with these labels. The Indian National Congress changed, split, and reformed in the half-century since independence, but until the 1990s, Indian general elections, with only fleeting exceptions, continued to be won by those who appealed to its historic aims and traditions. Though communism disintegrated elsewhere, the deep-rooted left-wing tradition of Hindu West Bengal, as well as competent administration, maintained the Communist Party, Marxist, in almost permanent government in the state where the national struggle against Britain had meant not Gandhi, not even Nehru, but the terrorists and Subhas Bose. Moreover, structural change might itself lead politics in directions familiar in the history of the First World. Newly industrializing countries were likely to develop industrial working classes who demanded workers' rights and labor unions, as the record of Brazil and South Korea showed, as indeed did that of Eastern Europe. They did not have to develop political labor-cum-people's parties reminiscent of the mass social democratic movements of pre-1914 Europe, although it is not insignificant that Brazil generated just such a successful national party in the 1980s, the Workers' Party, PT. But the tradition of the workers' movement in its home base, the automobile industry of São Paulo, was a combination of populist labor law and communist factory militants, and that of the intellectuals who flocked to support it was solidly left, as was the ideology of the Catholic clergy whose support helped to put it on its feet. Again, the rapid industrial growth tended to generate large and educated professional classes, which, though far from subversive, would have welcomed the civic liberalization of authoritarian, industrializing regimes. Such longings for liberalization were to be found in the 1980s, in different contexts and with varying results, in Latin America and the Far Eastern NICs, South Korea and Taiwan, as well as within the Soviet bloc. Nevertheless, there were vast areas of the Third World where the political consequences of social transformation were indeed impossible to foresee. All that was certain was the instability and inflammability of that world, to which the half-century since the Second World War had borne witness. We must now turn to that part of the world which, for most of the Third World after decolonization, appeared to provide a more suitable and encouraging model for progress than the West, the Second World of the socialist systems modelled on the Soviet Union.